Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Errol Laborde about his new book, Mardi Gras, Chronicles of New Orleans Carnival. We'll also hear from children's book authors debuting books during the recent meeting of the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance here. Board is one of those New Orleans journalists we count on for news and considered opinion. In his role as publisher of New Orleans Magazine and Louisiana Life Magazine, as well as producer of Informed Sources on WYES, he's a great lover of his hometown, as we learned in I Never Danced with an Eggplant on a Streetcar Before, Chronicles of Life and Adventures in New Orleans, and a passionate carnival aficionado, as we learned in Crew, The Early New Orleans Carnival, Comus to Zulu, and March the Day God, A History of the Rex Organization. Today, we'll be talking about a gorgeous new book, Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival. Errol, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi.
At last.
You know, I was driving here and I was thinking, this building, for those who don't know, it's in the UNO library. And it was as a master's student at UNO, when I was in political science, I was looking for a thesis topic. And I had kind of like a hippie professor. And at the time, there was a lot of issues about Mardi Gras, people talking about the relevance of carnival. And so he suggested, why don't you do it on Mardi Gras? I said, well, I hadn't thought about it. Now, growing up in New Orleans, I mean, I'd known Mardi Gras in terms of going to parades, and so I liked it from a street level, but I never really understood it. So it was actually in this library that I did a lot of the initial research for that thesis. And in the process, I'd read the other stuff along the way, and I kind of fell in love with Mardi Gras in this library, reading the other books, and so it's just good to be back here.
Oh, it's full circle.
So this is where the place happened, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Now, one of the things I love about this book, it's so elegant and beautiful on the outside, and then you open it up and the end papers just kind of explode with carnival right there. And it takes us through the season. It takes us from Twelfth Night to Ash Wednesday all the way through.
Yeah, I think it's a beautifully designed book. I think people at Pelican deserve a lot of credit. And indeed, the first chapter is about Twelfth Night. And I always believe any publication, if it's a magazine or anything, that you should have a punctuation at the end. And so at the very last page is we have a picture of a guy saying, you know, everywhere else tomorrow is Ash Wednesday or something. Okay. And so, yeah, I like having the punctuation.
Well, that's why you miss Comus so much, that parade at the end of Carnival.
Comus was the punctuation of Mardi Gras, unlike anything else that exists, because it would parade in the evening. And I used to love to go on Canal Street, where you can see down St. Charles, and you can see the Comus parade approaching. And I still remember, I mean, like the golden hue of the flambeau. And the Comus had these floats that were built on these old float beds, and so they would waddle. And the waddle was really a scientific consideration, because the waddle caused kind of a shimmy effect. So you'd have gold leaf on the side, and then with the flambeau light and all that, it would create this type of radiance. And it was a beautiful, beautiful sight. And of course, Comus went back to the origin of the parading tradition in Mardi Gras. And so it was great to see Comus ending it. And, you know, there would be people that say, they don't throw very much, or they don't have many riders. So what? It wasn't about throws. It was about the tradition and culture of Mardi Gras. And to the very end, they were still doing themes like the Legends of Gilgamesh and those sort of things, okay? I mean, they were still back to doing the classic themes in the tradition of the old style parade. And it's just too bad that all these generations have not been able to see that. I think the Proteus Parade is the closest to what a Comus style parade would have been. Mm-hmm. Or the Chaos Parade, which of course evolved from the old Momus Parade. Those would be 19th century parades. And so those are in that styles, but it was a loss to not have Comus.
Well, it certainly changed the feeling of the
sure
whole
did.
Celebration. Now, so many of these memorable stories, I mean, a lot of it's just straightforward history, and a lot of it's wonderful representations in art from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night on. But some of the great things in this book are just kind of down-home stories of people, like, for example, Perry Young, the carnival historian.
Yeah, one thing I tried to do in the book is that I wanted to tell a lot of the stories in the book. I wanted to do two things. I wanted to do some historical delving, because there's a lot about Mardi Gras history that's just wrong or misunderstood, or that's new discoveries. And so I want to talk about history, but I wanted to tell stories too. And so every section, I guess you'd call it a chapter, pretty much has what I call historical wanderings, for a lack of a better title, where I kind of talk historically about a topic, and then something called stories told, where I just tell a story about a person. And Perry Young was a man who was from Texas. I think he was from Abilene, Texas. And he came to New Orleans in the 1930s, and he worked for a company that did books for the port of New Orleans. But probably in that context, he met a lot of prominent people in New Orleans, because he really became part of the social life in New Orleans, at least had the doors open to him. And at some point, the captain of Comus hired him to do a book about the Comus Parade, and he wrote a masterpiece, and including, it's this preface that I always start off with, about Carnival being the butterfly of winter, which is the most beautiful metaphor ever written about Carnival. I mean, Perry Young could have written that first sentence and said, okay, I'm done, okay? And it would have been a classic, and guys like me would still be repeating. In writing the book, you know, I read his sentence, and he talks about Carnival being the butterfly of winters. But in the next sentence, he talks about the scattered, tattered remains are just parts of the collections of the day. And what he's saying is that, as beautiful as it is, that there's just a lot out there that just gets scattered. I said, well, that's the case here, too. That out in the field, there's a lot of butterfly wings, and if you collect enough, you got a hole of something. But the New Orleans Mardi Gras is just so rich. Obviously, I mean, you just can't tell it all. And so at that point, I realized that the best I can do is order collection of things that really, I admit, that interests me the most.
And the great thing about carnival historians is that they're all fairly generous. You all kind of support each other, and every new book is not competition, but an addition to what we know.
Yeah, there is some theory that take getting used to. I argue about the Americanization of Carnival. And there are some people who want it to be European in origin. All right? And it's European in the sense that the term Mardi Gras comes from France, and that it builds on French traditions and on European traditions. But the guys who built the Carnival in New Orleans were Americans, and they weren't like Creoles from New Orleans. These were people who were part of the East Coast migration who came across. And I think part of what they wanted to do, well, in terms of 1857, the guys who started Comus, there was a tradition of exclusive men's clubs throughout the world at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were drawing from that. It wasn't a sinister thing, and they just wanted to make it. But the guys who started Rex had a different mission, because this was in 1872, and this was during Reconstruction. And I think they clearly wanted to do something to soothe the wounds of Reconstruction, bring people back into the city, draw people into New Orleans. I have a chapter, which I'm really proud of, that talks about the 1870s, what was going on. Because this idea of using carnival as a way of drawing people in the community, and dare I use the term tourism, I mean, they weren't using that term, but it was becoming very popular. And in 1872, when Rex started, that same year, Mobile, which already had a parading tradition, established a character named King Felix and created the King of Carnival. Memphis started something called the Memphi. But I even found examples like in Europe, where the Civil War wasn't a factor, in Via Reggio and even in Nice. In Nice, you had a carnival tradition, but they kind of died out. By the 1870s, all of a sudden, you see these carnival celebrations rebuilding again. So why in Europe, okay? And the factor in Europe, there was also a factor in the United States, in addition to the Civil War, was the railroad.
I love that advertisement, yeah. You know, yeah. Take the train, see Mardi Gras.
Yeah, that railroad travel was becoming popular. And so I think people really, now that you had ways for people to get somewhere fairly quickly, and certainly in New Orleans in 1872, when Rex was established, you can see that there was evidence of flyers that were put up at railroad stations up and down the route, and they were saying, come to New Orleans on Mardi Gras and see the parade of the King of Carnival. They didn't use the word Rex very often. They referred to it more as the King of the Carnival. And so the railroads became, I think, a real factor in establishing. And one thing I find out about is that you look at Europe, and you know, people think everything is ancient in Europe, but like in Venice, which is one of the most honored carnivals in the world, which has carnival celebrations going back to the 1200s, but they stopped. And during the time of Mussolini, Mussolini said, no carnivals. I mean, carnival was dead in Venice. Mm-hmm. And you see a revival of carnival in Venice in the 1970s. And I think, just as the railroad spurred on stuff, but in the 1970s, you're starting to get jets flying across the Atlantic, okay? And so I think the people in Venice were probably seeing this as a way of developing international tourism for people thinking they're coming to see like an old, quaint tradition, you know? And it's done in the old style.
And you talk a lot about the economic impact of carnival in this book, and yet I think it's to our immense credit that with all this Americanization and modernization of this celebration, we've stopped short of totally commercializing it. It's not corporate sponsorship.
It really is, especially in the city of New Orleans, which I admire, that there are laws that you cannot have commercial sponsorship in parades. That would be so terrible. If that was going on, I probably wouldn't even be interested in Mardi Gras, that we've been able to maintain that tradition. Now, you get outside of New Orleans, and it starts to get a little bit fuzzy in terms of the interpretation. But we still make it that we have this very rare event. In an age when just about everything has a corporate sponsorship to it, that a crew is a crew, and it's the crew that pays for the parade. Now, some of them do other things. I mean, like Endymion, they have their big extravaganza, and that becomes like a money machine for them to pay for a big parade. Okay, but the big thing is that you don't have corporate signs on parades, and we've been able to maintain the integrity of that, and it's actually written into the law.
Another thing in this book, finally, and this is kind of the way I think of you, is the revival of Lundi Gras. I always think of you in your tux and your funny hat.
Yeah. Even though I argue it wasn't a revival, it was a creation, because what had happened is that there had been a tradition of Rex landing by river, and then it stopped in, I think, 1913. They did it one more time in 1971 for the Rex Centennial. It was a one-time thing, and then it just stopped completely. But that was just Rex arriving by river. And so what started in 1986, I believe it was the idea of trying to bring this all together, have Rex arriving. Originally, Proteus changed his route, so he came down Poydras, have music along the river. Until Lundi Gras started, there were no fireworks in Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. I mean, those fireworks in Mardi Gras seem like a natural, that they belong together. And so in this term Lundi Gras, like I said, I'm the one that said, let's call it Lundi Gras. And it came from there had been a musical for Nell Bagnaris then called Stagger Lee.
Right.
And Stagger Lee was about a night in the black Creole community the night before Mardi Gras. And they used the term Lundi Gras just in passing, but it wasn't a commonly used term. But I said, wow, what a great term. I mean, now it just sounds so common. And so we applied it, and the term just took off almost to a fault now, because now there's a tradition to get the word gras and stick anything in front of it, like family gras and that kind of thing. Okay, all right. But yeah, it really caught on, and it made something of that night before Mardi Gras, which is pretty much a dead night. All you had was the crew of Proteus, Path of the Night, and nothing else that happened. And the artists did have some positive impacts. I mean, that's another thing, okay, is that Proteus stopped parading for a few years, which wasn't a positive impact, but they came back. But anyway, during the time, the crew of Orpheus started, too. And so now on Lundi Gras night, you have Orpheus, which is a big parade, but the captain likes the tradition of the old-style parades. And so it's a pretty parade. To me, it's the prettiest of the Super Crews. And before that, you have Proteus. And so to me, the combination of Proteus on Lundi Gras, which is an old-style parade, and then Orpheus visually is the best combination in Carnival.
Now, also, one of the great and lovely things about this book is the way your own kind of love of Carnival and love of Peggy Scott Laborde is on every page of this book. It is so dear, with so many photos from your own private collection, just memories over the years. And I wonder if you'd tell us what it is that you and Peggy do at the end of Carnival. You have your own Carnival tradition.
Oh, well, that night we watched the Rex and Comus Ball. The only thing that's different about it is that we watched the Rex and Comus Ball from the broadcast booth.
Right.
From the WYS broadcast booth. And so we're actually located in a corner at the Rex Ball. And I, like many people, grew up watching the meeting of the courts. It used to be a half-hour broadcast on Channel 6. I watched it with my mom. My dad wasn't interested in that, but it was pretty much of a tight half hour that came on at 11:30. And you never saw the announcers. And like it was Gay Batson and Ann Merrigan. I mean, it changed through the times. And they just showed the meeting of the courts. And then so we had this opportunity when Rex celebrated the centennial to show the Rex Ball in its entirety. And they said, well, if we do that, why don't we show Comus? And Comus, being that it wasn't parading, I think that they realized that the visibility that they have now is by doing that ball. And so we do the ball. I mean, we do the Rex Ball, then we go over to the Comus side. It is not an event made for television. You know, I've tried to say, hey, look, when Rex and his queen meet Comus and his queen, could they like maybe have like a little drum roll or a little flash or something? No, well, we'll check. We'll come back to you on that. You know, but I respect that, too, because it still follows the traditions. And so it is the event it was intended to be that bows very little for television. But people like it. I mean, it has a good audience. It could only work in one city in one night of the year, and that's in New Orleans on Mardi Gras night. It couldn't work in Cleveland the 4th of July. But in New Orleans, it does. And for me, it's been a good opportunity, I think, to tell some history.
Absolutely.
To talk about the origin of AIDA and Verdi and how AIDA and Rex were contemporaries. That the first performance of AIDA was in December of 1871, which was only weeks before the first Rex ball. And so they were kind of like contemporary. They were, you know, part of the same thing. And so it's been a good outlet to kind of talk about history. And I understand, I mean, there's always people who kind of tease it. Ah, I saw it and I fell asleep, you know. But there's a lot of people who say just the opposite. I mean, they say, you know, we enjoy it's part of their ritual. And what I urge is you watch it and you have two things. You got moon pies and cheap champagne. And so I urge everybody has that. And so if they're not sleeping by then, probably the cheap champagne would do it. So.
And that's what you and Peggy always celebrate with, isn't it?
Yeah. And just watching the end. And to me, it's a very special moment. And you know, when we started doing it, like the high moment was the meeting of the courts, because that's what people always talked about. But once we're going to the Comus Ball, I mean, the meeting of the courts is fairly early in the Comus Ball. But I got to thinking, well, you know, there's another big event here, too. And this is when they actually close the curtains. And so I said, we need to start emphasizing this, which we do. I think it's a beautiful moment that there's this time when the Comus captain has escorted Rex and his queen out. Comus guy's captain, his lieutenant's the only ones there. And they go, and then they stand, and the curtains close, and that's the end of the carnival season.
Well, there are a lot of beautiful moments like that in this book, in word and image. And you can meet Errol aboard when he signs Mardi Gras Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival, Tuesday, October 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Errol, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's fun.
The Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance met in New Orleans recently, drawing a host of booksellers and publishers and writers to our city. One of the features at this event was a sign around where booksellers could visit with a lot of authors in the same room, standing in line for new books. We decided to talk with some of the authors. It was like speed dating for books, and it was fun. First, we talked with Georgia novelist Gail Karwoski. Gail specializes in writing about disasters for young readers.
Hi, my name is Gail Karwoski. I'm here to tell people about my new book, which is a novel for middle grades kids from about the ages of 9 through 14 and on up till 90. And it's called When Hurricane Katrina Hit Home. It's a novel based on the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And I came to New Orleans looking for a universal theme in this specific event, and I'm quite sure I found it. It's all about why home is important, and New Orleans is the symbol of home for these two children who are stranded together on the same roof and forced to rely on their own resilience and understand each other's strengths as the hurricane sweeps away their homes and turns them loose to, I guess, depend on what they know and what they have inside them.
Best-selling author Annie Barrows was debuting the most recent in her popular series.
Hi, I'm Annie Barrows, and I am the author of the Ivy and Bean series, and I'm here because the brand new 10th book in the series has just come out. It's called Ivy and Bean Take the Case, and I gotta say, this is a fabulous book. It's a mystery. It's the first mystery I've ever written, and it's about Ivy and Bean becoming detectives. This book is for children 6 to 9, but actually everybody in the whole world should read it.
Best-selling author Lauren Miracle was unveiling a new title as well. She is one of the most banned or challenged authors for young adults, and she was here just before the start of Banned Books Week.
Hey, I'm Lauren Miracle. I'm here with my new book, The Infinite Moment of Us, which is for upper YA, and it is a love story that is all about souls colliding and bodies colliding too.
David Levithan is one of the most beloved of gay authors.
David Levithan, my book is Two Boys Kissing. It is a YA novel about, well, not just two boys kissing, but about maybe 10 different groups of boys kissing. And it's really about the generation that died of AIDS looking at the generation now and figuring out sort of what gay life is like now for teenagers.
Jenny Han unveiled the follow-up to Burn for Burn in her ongoing trilogy, Fire with Fire, co-authored with Siobhan Vivian.
Hi, my name is Jenny Han, and I am the co-author of Fire with Fire, the second book in the Burn for Burn series.
And my name is Siobhan Vivian. I am the other half of the Vivian Han duo.
This is a book about revenge. It's set on an island, a lot like Martha's Vineyard. And it's really about three girls who are outsiders who come together to take revenge on those who have wronged them.
And it's full of twists and turns, romance, all the things that teen girls love to read about.
And Michael Brinkley taps into young readers with the latest in his series.
My name is Michael Buckley, and my book is Nerds 5, Attack of the Bullies. It's the fifth in the Nerds series. The genre is middle grade, sort of what they call spyance fiction. A little bit of sci-fi, a little bit of spy espionage. It's about five very nerdy fifth graders who operate a spy headquarters in the basement of their elementary school. And they go out and save the world when James Bond can't get the job done.
We'll be doing more speed dating for books in the weeks to come. Wonderful Southern fiction was in abundant supply at the Southern Independent Booksellers meeting. After lugging my book bag home, I curled up with these two novels and found myself reluctant to leave the reading chair. It's hard to beat the opening Kathleen Kent has concocted for her third novel, The Outcast. First, there's the lost treasure of Jean Lafitte the pirate. And then there's Lucinda Carter, a woman escaping from a brothel. The Gulf Coast in the 19th century, 1870 to be precise, was a rough and ready place, filled with brigands and outlaws and, oh yes, lawmen. As Lucinda makes her way to meet a former client, turned real-life lover, she hopes, she's reaching for a new life. But chasing after her intended are a trio of Texas lawmen, George Dearling, Dr. Tom, and Nate Cannon. These two plots wind and bend around each other with surprising twists and turns through Houston, Galveston, Middle Bayou, and New Orleans. All the characters are outcasts in some way, yet all are bound together, inexorably drawn to confrontation after confrontation. These frontier days, so rough and ready, are evoked with passion and detail and energy, and you'll find yourself racing to the end of what is a fine adventure story, including an unforgettable sharpshooting match in old New Orleans. The Outcast is a Southern novel, and it's a Western, too, the best of both worlds. In Love and Lament, John Millikan Thompson's protagonist is on the other side of the law. In fact, Mary Beth Hartsoe becomes the first woman sheriff in North Carolina. Mary Beth comes of age in the years between the Civil War and World War I, and her story is indeed one of love and lament, as she is constantly on the edge of losing everything, her eight siblings, her mother, and eventually her father, lost to madness. Her struggles illuminate the precarious position of women in that era, but they also show that an unfettered and determined girl can certainly make her way in the world, as Mary Beth does. She is a well-rounded and lovable character, and as readers, we fear for her and worry for her. She is haunted by the memory of loss after loss, and yet carries on, making her way from childhood home to boarding house and onward to the sheriff's office, hunting down bootleggers and moonshiners, taking care and keeping the peace in the ways that only a woman can. This is an absolutely moving story of a woman in full. As Millikan writes, life was strange, rich, terrible, wonderful. Everything that had brought her to this point, it would never go away. Her memory was too good, and that was her blessing and her curse. She believed her future was written, and though she was afraid of it, she still wanted to see what was going to happen. Readers will want to see what's going to happen, too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. John Mosier signs for Done, The Lost History of the Most Important Battle of World War I, 1914 to 1918, Tuesday, October 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. The featured reader in the 1718 reading series this month is Daniel Brook, author of A History of Future Cities, Tuesday, October 1st at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. One Book, One New Orleans presents a panel discussion, Who Voodoo the Voodoo, a panel by scholars and practitioners, Wednesday, October 2nd at 6:30 at Tulane University's Freeman Auditorium. This will provide context for the community-wide reading initiative selection, Erna Broadbear's Louisiana. Bill Lavender, accompanied by Jay Bernstein, debuts his new novel, Q, Wednesday, October 2nd at 8 p.m. at BJ's Bar, 4301 Burgundy. Robin Bridges signs the young adult novel, The Katerina Trilogy, Volume 3, The Morning Star, Thursday, October 3rd at 4 at Octavia Books. James Marriott and Mika Minio-Paluello discuss and sign The Oil Road, Journeys from the Caspian Sea to the City of London, Thursday, October 3rd at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Kathleen Kent signs The Outcast, Thursday, October 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. David Rich signs Middlemen, Friday, October 4th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Denise McConduit signs The Boy Who Wouldn't Read, Saturday, October 5th and Sunday, October 6th from 1 to 2 at the Pontchartrain Park Playground's Gentilly Fest at Prentice and Press Drive. John Milliken Thompson signs Love and Lament, Monday, October 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans presents a workshop on copyright law by New Orleans intellectual property attorney Marie Breaux, Monday, October 7th at 6:30 at Loyola University's Miller Hall, room 114. All are welcome. Today's guest, Errol Laborde, signs Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival, Tuesday, October 8th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Roger Kamenetz and Michael Hofka sign To Die Next to You, Tuesday, October 8th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents photographer Richard Sexton and writer Randolph Delahanty, celebrating the 20th anniversary of New Orleans Elegance and Decadence, Tuesday, October 8th from 6 to 7:30 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. Free, but call 523-4662 to reserve a space. Garden District Bookshop is presenting Chuck Palahniuk's Adult Bedtime Stories, Thursday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at Tipitina's Uptown. This is a ticketed event. Cult icon author Chuck Palahniuk, author of Fight Club and Choke, is debuting Doomed, the sequel to 2012's Damned, along with fellow writers Chelsea Kane and Monica Drake. Wear your jammies, bring your teddy bear. Garrison Keillor appears and signs Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical, Vulgar, Pathetic, and Profound, Thursday, October 10th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center. This is hosted by Garden District Bookshop and is a ticketed event. The Walker Percy Center at Loyola University presents its second biannual conference, Still Lost in the Cosmos, Walker Percy and the 21st Century. That's October 11th and 12th at Loyola University. Percy biographer Paul Eli is the keynote speaker on Friday evening, and Tom Key presents Tom Key Gets Lost, based on Lost in the Cosmos, on Saturday evening. During the day on Friday and Saturday, 42 panelists from all over the country will present 15 panels. Pre-register at loino.edu/WPC or at the door. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.